You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast, for one of our favorite annual podcasts. Because we only have like two of them. But this is definitely one of our favorites. It is time for the Seattle Sports Year in Review. And because it is 2019, not just year in review, but decade in review.
And it's been, as all years are, an interesting year in Seattle sports. I think that we have some figures who emerged in this last year who we weren't talking about a year ago. Potentially our sports figure of the year in Seattle sports was not somebody who we were really having a conversation about a year ago.
Perhaps we were having a conversation about a person they're in a relationship with.
Potentially.
Can't rule that out.
And definitely saw some figures from the past who have been steady throughout the last decade, but then also new stories emerge in the last year.
As they always seem to do. Let's start with our top 10 stories of the year, and we begin with our honorable mentions. The Seahawks handing the undefeated San Francisco 49ers their first loss on Monday Night Football. It was a good one. Natasha Howard winning WNBA Defensive Player of the Year honors. UW softball reaches the Women's College World Series. Jordan Morris voted MLS Comeback Player of the Year. A great year for Jordan Morris. Mike Hopkins repeats as Pac-12 Coach of the Year. Seahawks trade Frank Clark, a notable emergency podcast. He'll come up again. Rain FC announces its move to Tacoma. And then subsequently, this will probably be in 2020 that it becomes official, but their potential purchase by Olympic Lyonnais. So that'll be intriguing. UW men's basketball lands a pair of top 10 recruits in Jaden McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart. Sounders defender and longtime stalwart Chad Marshall announces his retirement midseason. And lastly, one of the happiest news stories, I think, of 2019, Seattle Storm coach Dan Hughes beats cancer and returns to the sidelines after a leave of absence. All right, to our top 10. Number 10. Matisse Thybulle named National Defensive Player of the Year. Like, we'd known how good Matisse Thybulle was for a long time defensively, particularly in the zone. But last year was Matisse Thybulle's national coming out party.
When it continued through being drafted higher than I think we were anticipated.
Yeah. Becoming an NBA sensation, even though no one in the NBA can correctly pronounce his last name.
Oh, how do they pronounce it?
Thybulle. A lot of Thybulle.
Has he become an NBA sensation?
He's been at least at like the podcast level. I don't think he's like, you know, I don't think that they're like talking
Which
out of
level
it
of the NBA,
the NBA
is the podcast level.
That's an important level, good
he's
sir.
He's risen to the podcast level of
That's
NBA.
That's my sensation. Level of the NBA.
Okay.
Oh.
So Matisse Thybulle has risen to your level of the NBA.
Well, he was already on my level. Everyone else is getting on my level, is what I'm saying. Look,
there are a lot of players who can do sort of similar things in all of basketball. And a lot of players throughout college basketball who can do sort of similar things. There are a lot of players who can shoot. There are a lot of players who are athletic and lanky but haven't quite put it together. The thing that Matisse Thybulle brings to the table, his combination of being able to read where plays are going,
yep,
having the athleticism to be able to go and block shots and get steals.
And the length.
It is a unique skill set, really, to Matisse Thybulle and a very small group of others.
I mean, he did things in the UW zone that had, at the statistical level, that had been never done before in terms of steal and block combination, at least at a power conference school. So,
I mean, we talk about these players in the NBA being unicorns, right? Where it's like, now there's
wildly
all sorts
overused
of athletic
term.
Seven-footers, right?
Well, the original thing was seven-footer who can shoot, someone who can block the shots and shoot threes.
But there's so
and
many of those players now. Like, it's not that unique of a package anymore. What Matisse Thybulle brings to the table and what he's doing in the NBA is more, I mean, he's not a better player than Porzingis or whoever, but like, it is a more interesting skill set than a lot of players in the NBA.
Matisse Thybulle better than Kristaps Porzingis. You heard it here first. Also, it was not enough for Matisse Thybulle to win Pac-12 Player of the Year. That honor going to his teammate, Jalen Noel. Mm-hmm. In the number 9 news story, the Seahawks just ahead of the 2019 season, another emergency pod worthy event. Trade for Jadeveon Clowney. A move that hasn't necessarily translated into a ton of sacks this season, but has certainly translated into a lot of impact.
When you mentioned one of the honorable mentions for Sports Story of the Year was that victory against the 49ers on Monday Night Football.
Yeah.
Thank you to this transaction for that victory.
Absolutely.
Seeing what Jadeveon Clowney has been able to do, I mean, this has been... Mohamed Sanu got traded for a second-round pick.
Wow. That is a thing that happened.
Right? Think about these players, which I don't know Mohamed Sanu's contract or whatever, but like players who will never have the kind of impact on the field that Jadeveon Clowney has had this season.
I mean, the Texans did get Jacob Martin, and he did have that sack on SNF against the Patriots.
Oh, well, so, yeah.
Yeah. They get something out of it.
But the Texans, as a playoff-bound team, being willing to trade Jadeveon Clowney for a fifth-round pick to the Seahawks, who needed pass rush more than anything else... This was, it's still shocking to this day.
The Seahawks had uniquely strong leverage there. It was very beneficial for them. Or Clowney had uniquely strong leverage and wanted to come to the Seahawks. Number eight, sticking with the Seahawks. That was a hello. This a goodbye. The Seahawks say goodbye to both Doug Baldwin, who announced his retirement, and Earl Thomas, who departed via free agency for the Baltimore Ravens, two stalwarts of the team throughout the decade. Are you too sad to talk?
A bit, Earl Thomas in particular.
I mean, Baldwin is kind of sadder because of the fact that he can't continue to play football. Like, he, you know, was forced out of the game so young. We've seen it before. We saw it with Cam Chancellor, obviously. But, you know, Earl Thomas gets to continue to play football. It's just sad that he's not doing it for the Seahawks.
Yes.
And at a very high level.
And I think when we look at the last couple of years, the Seahawks have been afraid to give players the third contract if they aren't Russell Wilson or Bobby Wagner.
Yep.
And the couple of big name players that they haven't done that for are still thriving.
That is quite accurate.
So who knows long term, maybe it'll be a good decision, but in the end, I personally will admit that I was wrong on Earl Thomas.
But you thought he was not going to continue to play at this level?
I wasn't convinced that it was worth paying him. And given the confines of the salary cap,
it's still payroll.
I mean, I'm willing to take the L there because Earl Thomas is playing at a high level, has recovered from the injury. We've seen basically no effects from it. Same with Richard Sherman.
Number seven, UW football loses to Ohio State in their return to the Rose Bowl for the first time since the 2001 season.
And you were at this game.
I was at this game. It was a great moment nonetheless. Like, it was an honor just to be there. Truly an honor just to be there. I enjoyed it, unlike Coach Pete, which led to a subsequent news story on this list. Number six, Brianna Stewart tears her Achilles playing overseas in the EuroLeague Final Four, and Sue Bird undergoes knee surgery just before the start of the 2019 WNBA season, robbing the defending champion Storm of two of their key players. And it was an impressive season nonetheless by the Storm to get back to the playoffs, to win a game there against the Minnesota Lynx at home, but certainly not the same team that they would have been trying to defend their title with a healthy lineup. Number five, you talked about this earlier, the players that the Seahawks were willing to commit to and keep around. The Seahawks extend both Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner. I think we all remember where we were when we saw that video of Russ in bed. Talking about his extension.
Probably in bed ourselves. It was very late.
I don't. I definitely didn't see it until the next morning.
That was in 2019?
Yes, we'll get to more on this.
It feels like it was so long ago, doesn't it?
I mean, yes, but it doesn't feel like it was longer ago than the Rose Bowl, which feels very long ago in its own right.
But again, they sort of looked at the situation. Bobby Wagner hasn't had the same kind of injury history that Richard Sherman and Earl Thomas have had. He hasn't had the one severe injury like each of them have had.
Kind of looked like he might have had it on Sunday at Carolina, and thankfully did not.
But he's been the stable and steady force on the defense, and Russell Wilson is the franchise.
Number four, UW men's basketball returns to the NCAA tournament after an eight-year absence and wins a game beating Utah State in the opening round before bowing out in a hard-fought game against North Carolina. Number three, Megan Rapinoe wins the Golden Ball as the best player at the FIFA Women's World Cup, leading the U.S. Women's National Team to their second consecutive World Cup victory, leading scorer for the U.S., and just emerges as a dominant cultural figure. I think we'll probably talk more about this soon.
Yes.
Number two. So I did this list originally in late November. I was getting working ahead,
wow,
as the kids say. And the Megan Rapinoe was in number two spot. And then she was bounced out of that because subsequently, at the start of December, we were shocked when Chris Peterson announced his resignation as head coach of the UW football team
and was replaced by Jimmy Story?
I mean,
I don't even know what's coming for number one.
Well, there's one obvious thing left.
I guess so. I don't know. This was shocking.
If you want to say 1A, that's fine by me.
I mean, this was, his resignation was something that maybe there were some Seahawks or some Husky beat writers on Twitter who saw it coming from a mile away. But for us, he looked like he was going to be the coach for the next decade. We thought we were going to be having this podcast talking about the state of Husky football for the next decade and saying that at least we have a steady as a rock coach. And now we'll be going into the 2020s with a huge question mark.
I don't know if I would have said the next decade. It was interesting. I hadn't read until well after the fact. The Athletic did a cool piece where they had all of their NFL beat writers ask former Huskies who are in the NFL their reaction to Chris Peterson's announcement after it happened. And a number of them, a theme that seemed to come up was, well, I could have seen this happening in 4 or 5 years, but I didn't expect it now. And I think that's probably a fair take for where I was on this.
I was shocked by it completely. I don't know. I mean, maybe everybody else really understood Chris Peterson as a person better than I did. But when you are a successful head coach of a college football program, that's a successful, a big-ish program, you just don't leave that easily.
Yeah.
Especially to
walk
away.
I guess people do, because we have seen it repeatedly with Urban Meyer and at Oklahoma. Why am I blanking on?
Bob Stoops.
Yep.
I would say that with Urban Meyer, there were extenuating circumstances both times.
Well, I mean, particularly the first time with the health issues. The second time, it's tough to say how much that was a factor.
But there was nothing like
Stoops
that.
Stoops is
Chris
probably
Peterson.
A closer comparison. Although he had been probably more embattled in terms of their bad defense for a period of time.
Yeah. I mean, Chris Peterson had not 100% approval rating, but he had a very high approval rating.
It was slightly less than it was a year ago. Number one news story of 2019, because it doesn't happen every day that Seattle wins a championship, and that happened this year with the Sounders winning MLS Cup at home, is the conclusion of a shocking playoff run, knocking off a historically dominant LAFC team on the road in the Western Conference Final, a team that at midseason you were predicting Brian Schmetzer was Schmetzer.
That should have
be
been
fired.
my bold prediction for 2020 is that at some point in calendar year 2020, I will predict that this is Schmetzer. He's gone.
I mean, the MLS season is long. It is not that long. Brian Schmetzer, no, with two MLS Cups in the last 4 years, he has lifelong job security in Seattle.
I don't know about that.
I mean, his popularity is so great. We'll probably talk a little more about that. But also just kind of the moment of this, the way the Sounders captured the city that week leading up to MLS Cup, having the opportunity to play for the first time in MLS Cup at home. It was a big moment.
I think that is the reason that this is such a big story.
Right.
And if them playing this match at home in front of a packed CenturyLink field is a pretty awesome situation.
It was. Yes, because they were not the number one news story when they won on the road in 2016. That year, I went with UW going to the college football playoff as the number one story ahead of the game, UW's game against Alabama.
If I have to dispute this being the number one story, the Sounders kind of go to the MLS Cup final a lot.
I mean, it is true that the Huskies making a coaching change is rarer than the Sounders going to the MLS Cup final.
A lot more rare.
I mean, not historically, but within the last 5 years, for sure. Let's move on to our Seattle Sports Figure of the Year and look back on how we've awarded this. We first did it in 2013, the first year of the Pelton cast. That year, you had Russell Wilson, I had Pete Carroll. Individuals are not eligible for multiple selections, much like the Seattle Sports Star of the Year awards. 2014, you had Richard Sherman, I had Marshawn Lynch. 2015, you had Michael Bennett, I had Russell Wilson. 2016, you had Chris Peterson, and so did I. 2017, you went with them. That was also, I believe, the year that were you with Kevin Durant as your honorable mention.
Yeah, that was a good one. A
famed performance. 2017, this year, I don't know, maybe you'll mention it. Maybe you shouldn't spoil it. 2017, you had Clint Dempsey. I had Tim Leiwicki. 2018, we both had Sue Bird. And that brings us to 2019.
Do you want to go first?
Okay. I had Brian Schmetzer. I mean,
We'd never had Schmetz before?
No.
You just read through all the names?
I really did, yes. It was a full list.
And none of them were Brian Schmetzer?
None of them were Brian Schmetzer. I mean, on top of everything else I just said, the fact that this was a Seattle guy, a Seattle native, someone who played for the Sounders in their NASL incarnation, has been involved in so many Seattle soccer franchises, including, you know, back when I did my Key Arena history, I talked to him about playing for the Seattle Sea Dogs of CISL in Key Arena. And for him to get this opportunity and make good on it and deliver not only a second MLS Cup trophy, but also to do it at home in front of a completely sold out stadium for the first time in Sounders history. Like all of that, I mean, it was Schmetz's, it's Schmetz's year.
Sure.
All right, who's your pick?
Megan Rapinoe is the Seattle Sports Star of the Year. Megan Rapinoe, Brian Schmetzer won MLS. Megan Rapinoe won the World Cup, the entire world, the Ballon d'Or. The best player in the entire world for this year was playing football in the city of Seattle.
Well, no, I mean, she was playing in Tacoma. I don't know
technically
if that
Tacoma
one was. But also,
in the greater Seattle area, and you're talking about a coach who won MLS, like, this is a unique feat.
I'm never going to say anything negative about Megan Rapinoe, who is awesome. But
you seem like you're about to.
This wasn't a Seattle thing necessarily, because of the fact that she barely played for Reign FC after the World Cup. Like, this was a national thing more than it was a Seattle thing. That's what I would say is the distinction between Rapinoe and Schmetzer to me.
I mean, that's probably part of it, but taking a player who's from Seattle and playing in the Seattle area and having them shine on the international stage worldwide, like, that is a huge feat. People from women's soccer fans throughout the world hate Megan Rapinoe.
Wait, what?
I'm saying,
like, also other countries?
Yeah, other countries. That's how good she was in this World Cup.
I think most of her haters may be within this country. And, you know, not as avid followers of women's soccer, but followers of politics, perhaps.
That too. But Megan Rapinoe won the World Cup, won the Ballon d'Or, and won this year.
I thought it was good. I asked you previously who you were going to pick, and because I wanted to make sure that you were going to pick Rapinoe, because she obviously deserved to be mentioned, but I did want to pick Schmetz for the reasons that I outlined. So I think it's appropriate that both of them, and maybe it indicates that 2019, as much as many years were the year of soccer in Seattle in the past 11 since the Sounders were born in their MLS incarnation, 2019 was really the year of soccer in Seattle between the combination of those two.
But there was an honorable mention that had to come up here.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't find the tweet for it.
It wasn't a tweet.
What was it? Was it an email?
It was an audio clip.
An audio clip.
We're talking about what we think we're talking about,
I don't
right?
think we're talking about the same thing. Maybe we are. There was somebody who mentioned this, I think.
Oh, someone who emailed us about this?
Yes. I'm not seeing anything on Twitter. But an honorable mention has to go to Damian Lillard.
Let me drop in the audio clip that we previously had.
Yeah, you kind of changed the fortune of a franchise with that that shot. Last question.
What can I say? That was that was for Seattle.
I love it. I love it.
In one shot, he not only ends the Thunder season, he ends the Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, James Harden dynasty. It's over.
I mean, I hate to break it to you. That dynasty was already over. But the Westbrook era, for
sure. One by one, all of these players went away. And I can tell you that that shot definitely was a factor in Paul George requesting a trade this offseason to go to the Clippers. Like, it mattered.
I don't know that you can tell that definitively, but yes, it seems very mattered. Likely to be the case.
I mean, so he not only ended the Thunder season, he set them back as far as being legit contenders for at least a half decade.
Until they come back even stronger with the 9 first-round picks they acquired.
You know what? No matter what, it'll feel different. Like,
yes, I agree.
This particular incarnation, Russell Westbrook
was drafted by the
last player on that team drafted by the Sonics.
Yes.
He's really the last Thunder player who we will feel strong feelings about, I think. Like, at this point, you know, it's been a decade, as has been oft discussed. And it's like, any player who comes after this, I don't hate Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, right? Like, I generally don't want the Thunder to win, but it feels different with this next generation of players that are coming than it did. And them never winning a championship with having 3 MVPs on the team at the same time and having Damian Lillard in the Northwest.
With Kevin Calabro calling the game.
With Casey calling it. There's nothing more poetic.
That was quite a moment. Now let's get to our decade review, and we thought it'd make sense to kind of go through franchise by franchise how they did during the 2010s and how they project as we look ahead to the 2020s. Because definitely something we'll be able to tell as we go through this podcast is we sure could have seen this all coming a decade ago. Let's start, of course, with the Seahawks, who over the past decade are 157-1 during the regular season. That 637 winning percentage is fourth best in the decade. The Patriots are number one, of course, at 124-34. They can catch still the Pittsburgh Steelers, who are 102-55-1 if Duck Hodges throws enough interceptions over the last 2 games of the regular season.
We couldn't have predicted a decade ago Duck Hodges.
Could have predicted 2 months ago Duck Hodges. And also the Green Bay Packers have an identical 100 wins but have 2 ties. Wow. In the past decade, so they are a half game ahead of the Seahawks in those standings. 8 playoff appearances in 10 years for the Seahawks after they clinched in 2019. The average team, of course, would have 4 over that span, so the Seahawks double that. Reached Super Bowls 48 and 49. One of those was canceled. The other of them, they won.
This was probably, you may dispute this, this is probably the best decade that a Seattle sports team has ever had.
I think the only other competition comes within this same decade.
From the Sounders.
Yeah, because, I mean, whoever else you're going to throw out there, I don't even know who else you would throw out there. Like the 90s, the 70s Sonics, it wasn't a whole decade. The 90s Sonics never got over the top. I don't see any competition. 2000 Seahawks.
When Husky football was sort of
cross-decade,
like the whole 90s wasn't great for Husky football.
Yeah, there were some rough moments in the 90s, for sure.
And I think when we're talking Sounders, the level of the competitive balance has to come into question.
Yeah.
Because doing this in soccer is significantly easier than it is to do it in football.
Oh, for sure.
Which we've seen, this is the fourth best record of any team during that time period. And I think the one steadying factor among all of those teams is having the same quarterback for that entire decade. Basically, the Seahawks are the one who had a different quarterback at any point during that decade.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. A great continuity for those teams in general. I mean, also 3 of them had the same coach the entire decade, which becomes easier when you win that many games, but still is notable. It stands out. Only Green Bay had a coaching change and went almost the entire decade, I think, because Mike McCarthy was at the start of he was at the start of the 2010s. So, I mean, Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll, the 2 constants of this period, is, and Bobby Wagner, I guess, to a slightly lesser extent. But whereas we have seen a turnover from the Legion of Boom being such a huge factor in the success in the 2 Super Bowl years and now completely gone, and the Seahawks, even if certainly not in terms of DVOA, having great success with an entirely different group on defense aside from Wagner and KJ Wright at linebacker. So how did the Seahawks set up for the 2020s?
Well, it's an interesting question because when you talk about those teams, the quarterback is all that matters, right? And if you were to say who are the teams who are best set up for the next decade, And you just look at the teams that have the quarterback. It's not going to be Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, and Ben Roethlisberger for the next decade. But Russell Wilson, who...
It's going to be Mahomes, Deshaun Watson, and Lamar Jackson.
And Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson will only be 41 at the end of this decade, which is...
Only?
But he could be playing through age 41.
We've seen some different age-related decline depending on quarterbacks. Obviously, Drew Brees and Tom Brady have been two quarterbacks who have been able to successfully stave off those effects over the past decade.
It wouldn't be that shocking if the season, if the Seahawks went into the 2020s with every single one of those seasons with Russell Wilson as their starting quarterback from day one.
I'm going to knock on wood here, but yes, that is, it's plausible. He's talked about wanting to play until age 45. Which, of course, would take him through the 2033 season, I believe.
There we go. Buckle up.
Will Pete Carroll still be the coach in 2033? Win forever. It is literal. It is not figurative.
And I think that the Seahawks are still in a good position. I mean, we came into this season thinking this team just isn't as good as they've been. The last three seasons, we're like, this defense isn't that good. You know, they don't really have the weapons, but they have a weapon that is more important than any of the other weapons that exist, right? You could have all the Christian McCaffreys in the world and still only have four wins.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to continue to draft and develop well around him. And, you know, I think that I'm encouraged by what we've seen over the last couple of years in terms of the Seahawks better valuing draft picks. Not necessarily encouraged by how they've used their first-round draft picks in that span, but the pieces are in place. There's no guarantees, but the pieces are in place. And one of the big questions is, Pete Carroll probably will not coach the team through the entire 2020s. And what happens with that transition and how they replace him and, you know, whether he hangs on too long. Some people may already think he's hung on too long. I'm not among those. That will be interesting to watch over the next decade.
I don't think for a decade of football beyond this, though, there's really anything else that we can project other than they're in a good position right now. They've been fairly responsible with the cap. In the last year or so, they've been fairly responsible with draft picks. As long as John Schneider is there, we know they're going to trade down, and we know that they're going to be picking up multiple draft picks. They're going to continue to be trying to build up the roster the most responsible ways that they can, and that's how you can keep this thing going.
UW football went 84-48, a .636 winning percentage over the last decade. That's fourth in the Pac-12 behind Oregon's 100 wins, Stanford's 98, and USC's 86. In Pac-12 play, they went 54-36 for a .600 winning percentage. And this is kind of remarkable. In 2010, the Huskies went to a bowl game for the first time since, I'm doing this off the top of my head, I forgot to look it up, 2003, I believe, was the previous time they had been to a bowl game before that. Now their 10 consecutive bowl appearances every single year of the decade is the longest current streak in the Pac-12. Went 3-6 in those games so far, pending the Las Vegas Bowl this Saturday. Won the Pac-12 championship in 2016 and 2018. Reached the college football playoff in 2016. Returned to the Rose Bowl in 2018. 9-1 in Apple Cups in the 2010s.
Wow.
And did that despite some turnover, Steve Sarkisian leaving after the 2013 season to take the USC job, replaced by Chris Peterson, who, as we discussed earlier, will step down at the end of the season to be replaced by defensive coordinator Jimmy Lake.
And it was a pretty incredible decade for the Huskies. We kept thinking this was a dormant powerhouse.
Yes.
Right? And eventually, at some point, I think Steve Sarkisian recognized that. And I think that Chris Peterson also recognized that. Coaches who were in demand and left other jobs to come here and be the head coach of the University of Washington.
I mean, I saw a thing lately about, you know, like Nebraska fans worrying that their school may never get there again. And it's like, the lesson of UW, I think, and maybe it's different if you're in Lincoln, Nebraska than in Seattle, Washington, but if you're a program with this kind of history, I mean, you know, I think there are other places that are not the most desirable places in the world to live that have no trouble recruiting college athletes. You're always one coach away.
Yes.
If you have those kind of resources and if you have that kind of track record,
and
you're always
one
course away. Yeah. Yeah. And if you're big enough that you aren't necessarily a stepping stone. Now, you know, Steve Sarkisian did move on and, you know, but that was to kind of, I think probably what was for him a dream job given his ties to USC and also, you know, just the one clearly bigger school in the Pac-12. So,
but I mean, Clemson is the one to me where it's like, we would not have had Clemson in a conversation of national powerhouses a decade ago.
No, of course not.
And now they've been to the playoff 5 years in a row and have done it with generation after generation after generation. It's like, we don't know that Jimmy Lake is going to be that coach, but, and that's why the Huskies, their future is much more unknown than basically any of the teams that we're talking about.
I don't know if I would say basically any, because of the fact that there is such certainty that these, you know, top programs are going to generally go to the same level. And they're set up to continue to recruit at, like, you know, pulling like the 15th best recruiting class or so on a regular basis going forward. And so if you have even average in-game coaching and playoff development, you're going to be in the mix in the Pac-12 on a regular basis.
Do you feel like the variance is potentially higher, though, with Jimmy Lake taking over the program?
Yeah, it's definitely higher with a new coach. Yeah.
Where it's like the chances of Jimmy Lake coming in and being this amazing college football coach, like, there's a chance that he's a better coach than Chris Peterson is, that he's taken all the positives from the Chris Peterson program and can translate that into being a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more public, and elevating what Chris Peterson achieved.
I mean, the other thing, you mentioned it with the Seahawks and the NFL, it's all about the quarterback position, and the difference in college is you can't keep the same quarterback for an entire decade. As much as some
schools
would love to
try. Jake Browning for an entire decade.
No, it wasn't. I looked it up.
Khalil Tate also, I think, was on Arizona for the entire decade.
I mean, there were a lot of quarterbacks in the 2010s. If you go back through it, Jake Locker was still the quarterback at UW at the start of the 2010s. There were so many Jakes left to come. So that will be crucial, and we'll see Sam Heward at UW presumably in the 2020s. Another thing that might be on the horizon, we might see an 18 college football playoff in the 2020s. So some interesting changes to come in college sports, as well as, we haven't even mentioned, the fact that players are going to start being able to be compensated off the field. So that will be an interesting change for all schools to navigate, including UW. It will also have an effect, certainly, in terms of men's basketball, where over the last decade, the Huskies went 208 and 139 for a 599 win percentage. That's including the 2009-10 season. I just threw the whole thing in there. They went 95 and 85, 528 winning percentage in Pac-12 play. Won a pair of Pac-12 regular season championships in 2011-12 and 2019-20. Pac-12 tournament champions in 2011 and three NCAA tournament appearances in 2010, 2011, and 2019. Which, you'll note, this decade was, I guess it wasn't like March. It started well and ended well, and in between, a bit of a trough.
Ended pretty well. And it started very well.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think you would have said at the start of the decade that UW men's basketball was set up probably as well as any sport in Seattle at that point, any team in Seattle at that point. You know, they'd had a couple years out of the NCAA tournament in the late 2000s, but Romar had seemed to get it going again with Isaiah Thomas. They made the Sweet 16 in 2011, and all systems seemed to go. They kept getting quality recruits, won the Pac-12 regular season in 11-12, and then Tony Roten missed some free throws at the end of a game against Oregon State, and it was all downhill from there for a period of about 6 years, I would say. Although, I mean, one thing is, you can overstate how bad the Huskies were. There was like two really, really rough seasons the year before Nigel Williams-Goss transferred, and then Markel Fultz's single season. Those were really rough Pac-12 years. Otherwise, the Huskies were around a 500 team in Pac-12. They were competitive, just not to the level you'd probably expect given the resources and recruiting ability at UW. You know, much as we're talking about with football, basketball is the same ability. But maybe, you know, you're probably third or fourth, I would say, in the Pac-12 basketball pecking order, where UCLA and Arizona are the like clear one and two long term, and then it's Oregon and UW probably. But should be better than they were in the middle and the end of the Lorenzo Romar year.
Well, I mean, I do think about, you've mentioned this a lot, Lorenzo Romar basically missed on three recruiting classes.
Yeah, there was a couple of years where they just went after guys they didn't get, or the guys they did get didn't pan out the way they expected.
And it derailed the entire program.
Which is the thing I think about that separates college basketball from college football. Like college football, because of the fact you're recruiting 20 guys a year, there's not as much variation year to year in recruiting classes. In college basketball, it can be a huge difference. And we're going to see this probably with UW over the next 2 years, because they're probably not going to recruit almost anyone this year. despite the likely loss of Jaden McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart to the certain loss of Jaden McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart to the NCAA or the NBA, because of the fact that they're setting up for the 2021 recruiting class, which is loaded in the Washington area, led by Paolo Banchero.
So, I mean, really, it'll come down to how they fare in a couple of recruiting classes and what the rest of the decade looks like.
And it may be a little different going forward, because another change that could be coming is the NBA will probably end the or will reduce the age limit and allow players to go directly out of high school. So that'll change things. You won't have these Jaden McDaniels, Isaiah Stewart, Markelle Fultz one and done seasons. And it'll be interesting.
You think Isaiah Stewart and Jaden McDaniels would have gone directly to the NBA, both of them?
Probably so, yeah.
Interesting.
So it'll be a little bit different playing field, I think, in terms of recruiting in the 2020s. And then the one question, like, I think we feel like Mike Hopkins is the right guy long term. There's probably still a small chance that he could see a larger program as his ultimate destination, whether that's going back to Syracuse, if, much like Pete Carroll, Jim Boeheim ever retires.
I think this is the biggest question mark, and to me the biggest question mark with the program in general is we don't know exactly what Syracuse means to Jim Boeheim, or to Mike Hopkins.
I think we know what it means to him, but yeah, I guess we don't know how much coaching there is a specific aspiration.
I would assume that head if coaching. That job opened up, that Syracuse would assume that Mike Hopkins will definitely go. But
I mean, I have some friends who are Syracuse alums, some coworkers, and they were like, yeah, he's probably going to be the next coach.
Yeah, they feel like this is a given, but we also felt that way about somebody like Jim Mora at UW.
Yep.
And that never came to be, and thankfully never will come to be. So there are things that seem evident when time passes and when an action happens, that all of a sudden maybe there'll be a new number two, right? Like, we don't know. Or Mike Hopkins might just pass on the job because the program looks better at UW than it does at Syracuse at the time. Like,
things were going so well at UCLA. Jamel Mora could not be pried away.
Yep.
Wow.
But at the same time, Syracuse may not be the only program to worry about.
Oh, for sure.
And that, I think, is the bigger issue, is like, if Mike Hopkins continues to coach well at UW, and he makes NCAA tournament after NCAA tournament, makes runs and runs and runs, bigger programs will come calling for him. And he doesn't have the same kind of ties to the area, or seem like the same kind of coach where he's like...
Well, he does have ties to the area.
He's not 100% UW for life, though, I don't think.
I'm not convinced of that. So, we'll find out. I mean, first off, if they keep making runs year after year, good problem to have.
This wasn't Lorenzo Romar who played here, though.
No. UW women's basketball went 188 and 148 so far in the 2010s, a 560 winning percentage, and were 82 and 97 in Pac-12 play, 458 winning percentage. NCAA tournament appearances three consecutive years in 2015, 2016, and 2017. Not coincidentally, the last 3 years that Kelsey Plum was at UW, the eventual number one pick led them to the Sweet 16 in both 2016 and 2017, and a surprising run to the Final Four in 2016. Four coaches for UW women's basketball in the 2010s. First, Tia Jackson, who was fired in 2011 and replaced by Kevin McGuff. McGuff got the program headed in the right direction before he left for Ohio State in 2013 and was replaced by his assistant Mike Neighbors. And then Neighbors, after Kelsey Plum's graduation, left for Arkansas in 2017, replaced by Jody Wynn. And it's been some trying seasons for the Huskies since. They're off to a solid 7-2 start in non-conference play this year, but seems unlikely that they will get back to the NCAA tournament this year. And that leaves probably a pretty uncertain future for UW women's basketball as we head into the 2020s and, you know, see whether Jody Wynn is the right coach or it's going to take another coaching change for the Huskies to get back on track. The Sounders, in the 2010s, as we already mentioned, the competition for the Seahawks is Seattle team of the decade for sure. 171, 111, and 84, a 606 winning percentage, 10 playoff appearances, and of course all 11 seasons in the team has played in MLS. Reached the MLS Cup Finals in 2016, 2017, and 2019, winning in both 2016 and 2019. Won the Supporters' Shield as the best team during the regular season in 2014, and then the champions of the U.S. Open Cup in 2010, 2011, and 2014. An incredible run of success. They were named the number one team of the decade by MLSsoccer.com earlier this week.
And this should continue. I mean, honestly, the talent pool in the MLS becoming so diluted with so many different teams. I think that teams like the Sounders, who are these steady teams who can go out and continue to pull in top tier talent, like, they're probably only going to get better.
Well, I mean, I think that the more skeptical view among Sounders supporters is that, as well as this franchise has made money and has been willing to go out and spend money over the past decade to bring in the best talent in terms of designated players, Obafemi Martins, Nicolò Ladero, Raul Ruiz Diaz most recently, there still has been a level of spending from Atlanta, from LAFC, from LA Galaxy, from the New York teams, NYCFC and the New York Red Bulls, that maybe the Sounders can't quite match that. So they're going to have to continue to be more efficient with their resources. Toronto as well, by the way, who they faced in all three of those MLS Cup finals, and suddenly has a lot more money to spend because Michael Bradley is no longer a designated player. He re-signed for targeted allocation money on an extension. So that's the worry. I think, you know, consistent playoff level success for sure. Can you continue to keep up? And what's the direction that MLS takes over the next decade? That's one thing we're going to find out, because they have a collective bargaining agreement that's up right now. And will they want teams to continue to spend a lot of money on those top talent, or will they want to kind of direct that more to the middle of the roster, to greater depth? That'll be an interesting question for MLS as a whole.
I think that's the biggest question, though, is not will the Sounders continue to be a top program in MLS. I think it is, what does MLS look like in a decade? They're expanding very quickly right now, and things positively or negatively could look very different. I think it's one of the hardest things to predict, MLS 2030.
Yeah, major question marks is they expand so quickly. The other thing we should mention here is one thing that will help the Sounders compete financially going forward is bringing in an infusion of new money with the additions to the ownership group that were made during this season.
Mm-hmm. Macklemore money.
Yeah, Russell Wilson money.
Uh-huh.
We talked about that extension, didn't we? No, it's but also the number of current and former Microsoft and Amazon employees who bought into the organization as well.
You think that actually was an influx of like cash for the Sounders?
I think that was part of the reason they wanted to, you know, there was the report that Joe Roth, who sold out his shares, had been approached by, you know, non-local investors who were willing to step in. So I think either way, it was, you know, just the valuation of the team that it was sold out was going to increase, you know, kind of their resources to an extent.
Okay.
The Seattle Mariners. They sure did play games in the 2010s. They went 758 and 862, a 468 winning percentage. Zero playoff appearances. Not a lot of playoff appearances in the 2000s either, or at least at the tail end of them. Now the playoff drought is 18 seasons and counting for your Seattle Mariners. Their best season in that span was 89 and 73 in 2018. And they lost 101 games in 2010, the first year of the decade. So the real question here is, how many wild cards will baseball have to add for the Mariners to be able to
all wild cards
make the playoffs? No, I mean, I will say I probably feel better about the Mariners' long-term future right now than I did at any point during the 2010s, because they actually do have a long-term plan and vision in place. I think they're in better hands from an ownership standpoint with John Stanton now running the club. And it's a question of whether Jerry DePoto can make good on these, you know, kind of the promise of long-term and develop the young talent that was at AA Arkansas this year into major league caliber players who they can eventually surround with free agents and not give 18-year deals to Robinson Cano.
Do we think that this is a more competent ownership group and John Stanton in general?
Yes.
He's more a fixture of the community. He's somebody,
I don't know if it's a fixture of the community, because Howard Lincoln was a fixture of the community. Chuck Armstrong was, presumably a fixture of the community. The issue was, I think that their goals were more to, you know, there was the infamous quote back in like 2002 about, look, our business plan doesn't include winning the World Series or something like that. I'm paraphrasing here. And like the point was,
look, our business plan doesn't include the playoffs for the last 20 years.
the point they were trying to make is like, look, we can't count on that. But also it sounded like we don't care about that much. We're just trying to consistently make money. And I think that there's more of an aggressive mentality and probably less meddling, I would say, under John Stanton. So those are all good things.
it does feel like, I'm trying to remember, there was a time, maybe this was the early 2010s, where they were trying to develop a bunch of the Jose Lopez era players, yeah, like that, like Young Felix, Jose Lopez, Vladimir Balandin. Like, it felt like there was a moment where they had some good young players, and then no, obviously Felix panned out, but like nobody else really panned out, especially as far as hitters. Yeah, the
player was really terrible at that point. So
that's going to be the difference. And we just don't know, right? Like,
we don't know.
The Mariners haven't really developed widespread talent at the major league level yet.
Here's the good news. It can't get any worse.
Can't it, though?
No, it can't. I mean, the length of the playoff drought can get worse. They won 47% of the games in baseball over an entire decade. That's really, they averaged 86 losses. That's so hard to do.
The Astros were the obvious example of kind of how to bottom out and then rebuild from there.
And then cheat.
I would say that the Astros got incredibly lucky during that process. It's not. It's like using the Thunder as an example. They drafted 3 consecutive MVPs. It's like your plan can't be, we're just going to draft 3 consecutive MVPs, because you can't just say this is the one time that it worked, therefore we can do this.
Well, the problem is also that a lot of teams are following this strategy, as we'll maybe discuss a little bit. Well, sort of. I guess it's because of the fact that I was going to boldly predict that the Mariners were going to have the worst record in baseball in 2019. I realized, no, there's some horrible teams out there, as it turns out.
We might have some tandem bold predictions.
Not 2020. That was 2019. I was considering as I re-listened to it. And a lot of teams are trying this strategy, but if the Mariners can hit on their young players and the draft picks they get, they do probably have enough financial resources to outspend some of the other teams that are trying to do this.
You have to hit on a lot of players, though.
At some point, they have to make the playoffs. Like, over a long enough timeline, the Mariners inevitably will make the playoffs again.
It's like the idea that the universe is so vast that there has to be another, like, life form out there. That's the Mariners with the playoffs.
Or the multiverse. The multiverse. There's enough universes that one of them, the Mariners, have made the playoffs in the last 18 years. Oh, boy. The Seattle Storm have made the playoffs in the last 10 years. They went 189-151, a .556 winning percentage. They made the playoffs 8 times in 10 years, which is more than I remembered. It seemed like a longer period there out of the playoffs, but they won the lottery both of the 2 years they weren't. Those yielded Joel Lloyd and Breanna Stewart, WNBA champions in 2010 and 2018. Brian Egler was the coach of the 2010 team, then left after 2014, replaced by Jenny Busek. Busek was fired midway through the 2017 season and replaced by Dan Hughes, who led the Storm to the 2018 championship. And much like UW men's basketball, but in a more understandable way because of the cyclical nature of pro sports, a really strong start to the decade for the Storm, who put up the best season in franchise history, one of the best in WNBA history, and winning the 2010 championship. Then a down period of time. They went through the process, tanked a little bit, got Breanna Stewart, and then rose back up to champions in 2018. And the future looks bright for the 2020s.
Well, the structure of the WNBA with so few teams is that at some point, pretty much every team has to have some sort of success within the decade, right?
Yeah, although, you know, it's slightly less than 80% of teams that make the playoffs. And 2 championships is still a lot in a decade.
How many teams are there in WNBA?
12.
There's 12 teams. So, like, yeah. On average, close to every team would get the first pick in the draft.
Yeah, but you wouldn't necessarily get it in here where Breanna Stewart was the first pick in the draft.
Breanna Stewart's just that much more important.
Yeah, I mean, she's the best player in the league when healthy. And we'll see what she is coming back from that Achilles rupture. But she'll be very good to have. And Natasha Howard grew into a force in her own right last season in the front court without Stewart alongside her. So now you put those two players together, it's exciting. Subird comes back to provide some veteran leadership. After Jordan Canada filled in for her at point guard, I think the Storm are in good shape heading into the 2020s, assuming Stewart is, you know, similar to what she was beforehand. The other thing we should probably talk about, we don't have like a specific decade in review, but we should probably talk about NBA and NHL over the past decade. So,
as it relates to Seattle?
Yeah. Because the decade started with Chris Hansen coming in. That was, I believe, the summer of 2012, I guess, where he was trying to get together a plan for an arena in Seattle and got it approved, and everything seemed great at that point. Then in 2013 or late 2013, early 2014, the reports that, you know, they've entered a new agreement to buy the Sacramento Kings to come play at this new arena that would be built upon their arrival. It seems like NBA is going to be back after not that long of a period. And of course, that does not transpire because the Kings end up staying in Sacramento, are saved by Vivek Ranadive and Kevin Johnson, Mayor Kevin Johnson and David Stern. Then, the Hansen Group continues on, but loses Steve Ballmer, who buys the Clippers midway through the decade. Lose a key vote on the street vacation of Occidental Avenue, which, you know, of course, is still a teeming, thriving arterial to this day because of the fact that it wasn't vacated by the Seattle City Council.
I drive it all the time.
In a shocking 5-4 vote that went against, that was thought was going to go 5-4 the other way in favor of the arena. And that opened the door then for Oakview Group and Tim Leiwicki to come in with a plan to rebuild Key Arena and eventually win an NHL expansion team that will begin play in 2021. And that arena renovation is well underway with just the roof remaining from what was Key Arena now.
As far as basketball goes over the last decade, every single thing that's happened with progress for getting an NBA team back has been negative, right?
I don't know if I would say every single thing, but yeah, pretty much.
Do you think that the city of Seattle, I guess two questions for you. Do you think that the city of Seattle is any closer to getting an NBA team back today than we were 10 years ago?
Yes, because there, you know, whatever year that was that Chris Hansen, I think it was 12, like then, no, but the arena was always the first step in this process, and that now there will be an NBA caliber arena. There are some issues in terms of dates and in terms of the financials of sharing money with hockey ownership and the arena ownership that, you know, I think are easier to resolve if it's the hockey ownership group also buying an NBA team, which is probably easier to facilitate with expansion than a move. But they will have an NBA caliber arena. That's the first step. So they're closer. How that team will come, when it will come, remain wildly uncertain.
Do we think that, give me a percentage chance,
that the NBA comes back to Seattle in the 2020s?
That we're at least at the point that we are with hockey, where it's like, it's inevitable.
Well, I mean, it's more than inevitable. It's like
that it's
in
done.
Process.
But I mean, the team is not playing here.
Yeah.
But that a team is coming to Seattle.
Okay, so either an expansion franchise has been announced or having it be inevitable with a move is a little harder. I would say 10 to 15% by the end of the decade. 10 to 20.
What do you think the chances are that the NBA announces expansion in the next decade?
5 to 10%.
Really?
I mean, so, by the entire end of the decade, yeah, I think it's possible.
By 2030?
Yeah.
So you don't think that they're looking at moving quickly on this at all? I mean, the thing that we talked about on our weekly podcast with Mexico City, that's going to be a long trial balloon.
Yes, that's a long-term play. TV contracts come into play here. CBAs come into play here.
There's just always a reason not to expand.
As long as it's Seattle, there's always a reason. God. Reason not. So that's a fun note to go out on. Now, let's do our Seattle sports figure of the decade. There are two options here. It's got to be either Russell Wilson or Pete Carroll.
It's Russell Wilson.
It is Russell Wilson.
Like, I think that we have enough evidence now that, look, Pete Carroll is a good coach. But, and we might have had a different answer for this 5 years ago than we do today, the most important part of the mix for the Seahawks is Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson overcomes Pete Carroll's bullshit to help the team continue winning.
As I said to you last week, I don't think I mentioned this on the weekly pod, the case for Russell Wilson for MVP is he's not only competing against the 11 players on the other team, he's competing often against his own coaching staff and sometimes even his own wide receivers.
But also, like, having been put in a situation where he has one of the worst offensive lines for basically his entire career, you know, like, they have not invested necessarily in quote-unquote weapons around Russell Wilson. Like, This team has gone out of its way to leave Russell Wilson on an island, and he has kept succeeding. He's brought Seattle the most important championship that it has ever won. Early in his career, he's repeatedly been in the
playoffs. Disrespect to the Seattle Metropolitans.
Russell Wilson has made the Seahawks the most important franchise in all of Seattle by such a significant margin, right? Like, the Seahawks, sports-wise, own the entire Northwest by a massive amount. And it is because of the success of this generation of players, but in particular, Russell Wilson.
I mean, I think what I'd say is, look, we saw the Seahawks with Pete Carroll, but without Russell Wilson. And I think that they would have developed into a real, you know, obviously they developed into an elite defense. We saw that in the second half of 11, and they probably would have been, you know, a consistent 10-6, maybe an 11-5 here and there. They wouldn't have been a Super Bowl team without a top tier quarterback. And that's what they eventually got with Russell Wilson.
Well, we also know that defense is not as consistent from year to year. We've learned this over and over and over again. We saw the rise of the Jaguars for a year in this last decade. We saw Blake Bortles in a conference championship game within the last decade.
And without even rules changes or a new offense and defense.
And those things can happen occasionally, right? You can have an elite defense for a year, but if you don't have the quarterback paired with a very good or elite defense, then you're not going to reach those heights. Especially consistently, and that's what Russell Wilson gives this program.
A couple other players we should mention here. Sue Bird has a strong case, played with the Storm the entire decade, two championships, incredible track record. You know, Megan Rapinoe doesn't have the same track record because she wasn't in Seattle the entire decade playing with Reign FC, but she's in the mix there. And then Felix Hernandez, who did not come up at all in the Mariners section. I mean, he probably is. It ended very poorly for him in a Mariners uniform, and that taints the memories a little bit. But it's also really just kind of the fact that his team let him down, and he never had a chance to perform in a big stage. We would look at him very differently if he had played for a competent major league organization.
It's a little crazy that we've been talking about the decade. This is the first time Felix has come up.
I know. Threw a perfect game in the decade.
But I guess not to harp on this, I think Chris Peterson is very important. Taking the Huskies to the college football playoff. And then just the Seahawks players who are around Russell Wilson for this area.
Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, Bobby Wagner.
Doug Baldwin, Cam Chancellor. Like, I like to think about how many players have we seen in the last decade who are going to be part of the Seahawks Ring of Honor? Because it is a lot of them.
They're
going
to have to actually expand the stadium to make room for more Ring of Honor recipients. Yeah, I mean, like most of the... if you go to the Pro Football Reference page where they've got players sorted by the photos of players by their career value to the organization, I would have to assume that, you know, I've not done the actual calculation, but the vast majority of them are players from the 2010s. So it goes Largent, Walter Jones, Cortez Kennedy. Well, I guess it's not as dominant.
It's actually shockingly few. There's a lot.
Wilson Wagner.
There's a lot of very old photos here.
Why is Earl Thomas not in the top 12? But Wilson, Sherman, and Wagner all are from this era. And that's out of four decades of the franchise.
I mean, players who are locks for it are Sherman, Earl, Bobby Wagner, Russ. I think Baldwin is too.
Yeah.
That's a lot of players for this team. And there's other players who are maybe like a little bit more on the fence. People like Cam Chancellor, but like...
I guess the difference is perhaps that a player like Joe Nash was more likely to spend his entire career in Seattle than players of this generation have been for cap purposes. Should we get to bold predictions? My favorite part of this podcast is always listening back to our old predictions to review them.
Oh, my God.
And let me tell you, they were not... I do either an X or a plus to show the results of the bold prediction. Not a lot of pluses this year.
Are we going to read Mina's also?
We are going to read
Mina's.
We had
Mina on with us for last year.
We decided not to ask her this year because we just had her on for the Rams podcast. Don't want to take too much of her busy time. But she was a part of this the last couple of years. All right, so we'll start with mine from 2019. Number one, Russell Wilson signs a contract extension within the week leading up to training camp. And I feel like a lot of these, I feel like my process was good, but the outcome was bad. And this one, I didn't foresee that Wilson was going to set this earlier deadline in April ahead of the draft to sign his extension. And they went up right up to that deadline.
Yeah, you knew they were going up to some deadline.
That's how deadlines work.
Yeah.
And I knew that people were going to freak out about it and that Colin Cowherd was going to be talking about Russell Wilson wanting a trade to the Giants.
The Giants.
And then everything was going to end up fine.
Do you think the Giants as an organization could even like accurately value Russell Wilson?
Well, that would be the reason to trade him to the Giants, I guess.
I think they would undervalue him, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they do have Danny Dimes at quarterback. I had another extension-related bold prediction. Bobby Wagner would sign an extension with the highest guarantee ever for a middle linebacker, surpassing Luke Kuechly's total, which he did. But unfortunately, so did C.J. Mosley with a larger deal earlier in the offseason. So I was wrong on that one. Again, the process, I feel like good.
Yeah.
Outcome bad.
Mosley!
Next up, Seahawks draft a kicker. I didn't realize instead they were going to go out in free agency.
Overpay a kicker.
Overpay Jason Myers.
That seemed like a freaking lock when you said that. I was just like, of course they're going to draft it. We knew that they would have a new kicker this year.
Yes,
we knew didn't know that they would Seahawks it, though, and only want players that were previously part of the Seahawks.
Robert Turbin came in for a workout. Next up, and moving to Husky football, Jacob Eason will be a healthy reserve at some point during the 2019 season. And I feel like I accurately gauged Jacob Eason. What I didn't see coming is that Jake Haener would transfer on the eve of the 2019 season after being beaten out for the starting job by
even,
Jacob
even
Eason.
If Jake Haener is on this roster, Eason would have never been a healthy reserve.
I don't know if you saw the Oregon State-Colorado games back-to-back. Did you watch those?
They were starting Jacob Eason every game this year.
I watched those. Sounders will finish atop the Western Conference in the regular season. I did not realize how dominant LAFC was going to be. I actually undersold them a little bit. Next up, UW men's basketball reaches the Pac-12 championship game for the first time since 2011, but does not make the NCAA tournament.
Wow.
So I was you had one flipped. For two on that one. No, they made the championship
game. Oh, they made the championship game.
Yeah, so I was predicting they were going to lose, which they did, but I thought they would not make it as an at-large, which they did. You at that point said you were not willing to make the bold prediction that the Huskies would go to the NCAA tournament because they were struggling in non-conference, turned it around in conference play. Lastly, among my official bold predictions, the Mariners will lose 100 games for the first time since 2010. Instead, they finished 68-94, so I went 0-4-7.
And the real loser was the Mariners.
I did get my bonus prediction, which is at the end, Mina alluded to doing a live podcast in Seattle, and I said that it would sell out, which it did within like 15 minutes.
Wow.
That was a pretty easy one. That wasn't that bold.
Yeah, we knew that was going to sell out.
Yeah. All right, Tristan's 2019 bold prediction.
You have so much glee reading these.
I do.
Oh, God. It's not... just like the over-unders. It's like, and for the Ravens, you said they would go under.
That's what the listener wants. This one you don't have. It wasn't anything as bad as 2 years ago when you said that the Rams and 49ers would play a DVOA bowl.
I really was just like a year off for all of it. I was thinking about that, the Rams 49ers DVOA bowl, and like...
That was my favorite.
Each of them peaked at the exact wrong time for that prediction. But my process was good on that. In fact, I'm taking that as a win.
You know, they didn't yet have. I guess they did have. They didn't have Sherman on the roster. You could, I guess, could have foreseen that. But they were bad on defense last year too. Like it wasn't.
At one point last year, the Rams were number one in DVOA. I'm sure.
They probably were.
And at one point this year, the 49ers were number one in DVOA.
Yes.
So.
All right, your number one bold prediction.
I'm taking a win there.
Was that the Seahawks will lose in the playoffs to the eventual Super Bowl champion. As it turns out, the Dallas Cowboys did not win the Super Bowl.
They did not.
The New England Patriots did instead. Next up, both you and Mina also had draft-related predictions that were very similar. Hers was that the Seahawks will draft a free safety with their first pick, which Marquise Blair was their second pick. Or the third pick, because Cody Barton was ahead of him as well. And you said specifically, or their fourth, because I think DK Metcalf was in there too. Your prediction was more specific that the Seahawks would take Taylor Rapp with their first pick. And instead, of course, he went to the rival LA Rams.
Well, at least Mina got to... I think that's who she was making the prediction on behalf of.
Oh, we're going to get to that.
So the prediction was that with their first pick, not with their first round pick, with the first pick in the Seahawks draft, that they would draft a safety... And that it would be Taylor Rapp.
No, you said specifically Taylor Rapp. She said a free safety. And it turned out neither of those were Eldrick Collier because there just weren't enough 28-year-old free safeties.
Well, we didn't know about the Frank Clark trade at the time.
We did not.
I think the Frank Clark trade definitely changed at least that first pick in the Seahawks draft. They didn't know Jadeveon Clowney was coming. They didn't know Ziggy Ansah was coming. So they had to go out there and make a bad draft pick.
Next up for you, Earl Thomas will be a New England Patriot.
Wow.
You were correct that he was going to go to an AFC power, but not that AFC power. I said back then, my thought was 49ers.
God, imagine if Earl and Sher were on the 49ers in that secondary. I don't think we'd be able to handle it.
Your next prediction, Russell Wilson, this time next year, will be the presumptive favorite for MVP.
So close. Pretty close.
Not far off.
Pretty close.
Mina's comment was, it's so hard with Patrick Mahomes.
Oh, which, wow.
Turns out injuries took that away.
We didn't know Lamar Jackson.
And I said, it's so hard with the Seahawks offense.
There was a point during this season that Russell Wilson was probably number one in betting markets for the MVP.
I don't know if he ever was in betting markets, but possibly. Your next bold prediction, the Huskies will repeat as Pac-12 football champions behind a defense ranked top five nationally. So instead, they finished behind Cal in the Pac-12 North standings because of alphabetical tiebreakers. So that's what happened.
I would have boldly predicted that Huskies would have finished behind a team because of an alphabetical tiebreaker. That would have been something.
Your next bold prediction, Jerry DePoto will no longer be the Mariners GM, which he is. And lastly for you, that this was, I think, maybe a bonus prediction, that Myles Gaskin will start in the PeltonCast Fantasy Football Playoffs. Wait, did someone actually start
Myles Gaskin? No, he's number one right now, though, in one of the leagues that I was in where they have the like flex section of players design. Uh-huh. Myles Gaskin is...
He sure was on the field a lot on Sunday for the Dolphins.
This is going into the Fantasy Football Final. Okay, so it's not quite that. Top available running backs in this PeltonCast Fantasy Football League. Kerryon Johnson, who for some reason is returning from IR to play for the Lions. Peyton Barber, and then Myles Gaskin.
He had nine carries for 43 yards last week, including a 27-yard run. The first extended action for Gaskin, who has 20 carries for 78 yards.
It was another Myles who broke out in this year's Fantasy Football Playoffs as a rookie running back.
That's true. All right, Mina's bold predictions. She actually got one. After both you and I went 0-7.
Her predictions weren't bold enough. If you get one right, it's not bold enough.
No, her correct prediction was sufficiently bold.
Pretty bold.
The Mariners will finish with a better record than the Rangers. That was not true, as the Rangers went 78-84. Frank Clark will briefly become the highest paid pass rusher in the NFL, and he did not surpass Khalil Mack's contract. It was also slightly behind DeMarcus Lawrence last offseason, and Lawrence signed earlier because Clark was not traded until just before the draft. But her last bold prediction that was correct, the Seahawks will have a better record than the Rams in 2019.
Wow.
That's a good one. And little did she know that
she was bringing them down from the inside.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to our 2020 bold predictions. It's time. You want to start us?
Are we going by team or should I just...
Yeah, let's go by team.
Well, this is more of a general one, but...
Okay.
Your week 14 Denver Broncos starting quarterback... You know who it is.
Jacob Eason?
Jacob Eason. Oh. No, I don't actually think Jacob Eason will start for the Broncos, but Jacob Eason will start an NFL game next season.
We have competing bold predictions.
Wow.
Because my bold prediction is that Jacob Eason will announce that he will return for his senior season at UW after a poor outing in the Las Vegas Bowl. I still get this as long as he returns, whether the outing is poor or not. But that's my logic here, is I do not like that matchup against the Boise State defense without Trey Adams.
There's going to be...
And without Hunter Bryan.
Some NFL team who, in practice, falls in love with Jacob Eason.
I mean, there's a just lot like, of quarterbacks in this year's draft, too. Like, and I think that part of his logic could be, like, look what happened to Joe Burrow from his junior year to his senior year. What if I can also complete 85% of my passes next season?
What if his logic was... Duck Hodges is starting the NFL right now.
That happens every year because of injuries. It's not like, I mean, the Steelers may draft a quarterback, but they had a grab quarterback they drafted, and he just failed.
David Blau is playing. Like
this always happens. This is not meaningful.
Jacob Eason will be that player. Also, Drew Lock.
Drew Lock is a better comparison. All right, do you want to do? You do your next one then, since. I did mine.
The Mariners will finally succeed in bottoming out after they trade Kyle Seager, D. Gordon, Mitch Haniger, everybody this offseason, and they will finally get the number one draft pick for the first time since they selected Alex Rodriguez.
I don't think that's going to happen. I looked at a bold prediction for the Mariners related to like the rookie record for home runs with Evan White or one of these guys from Arkansas, but it turns out Elvin Davis hit 27 as a rookie, so that's going to be pretty tough to top even in this era.
You don't think they could hit 27?
I think they can, but I don't think it's likely.
The ball's juiced.
That wasn't that juiced to double A, as it turns out. Since I don't have a Mariners one, I'll do my Storm one. They return to the WNBA Finals, but lose a rematch of the 2018 series with the Washington Mystics, who are the defending champions. I toyed with Jordan Canada will start more games than Sue Bird in 2020. I'm not sure if that's bold or not at this point.
Sue Bird will be an assistant coach for the Storm by the end of the 2020 season.
So she'll announce her retirement mid-season?
She'll be retired before the season, mid-season. At some point, and she will be on the coaching. She's 39 years old, coming off a severe injury.
Would have to have some kind of an injury setback. She's currently playing for the U.S. women's team and plans to play in the Olympics next year. That's her big thing. We'll see after the Olympics, but she definitely wants to get through to the Olympics. The Sounders reached the semifinals of the CONCACAF Champions League. This is the second time in 3 years I've made this same bold prediction. At least one MLS team has done it each of the last 3 years. The Sounders did it in 2013, and this has been kind of the great white whale for Sounders GM Garth Lagerwey, whose RSL team with the lost the 2011 CONCACAF Champions League final after getting that far. So that's going to be a big push for them next spring.
The 2020 season will be Jordan Morris's last with the Sounders.
This I feel like we've predicted so many times.
It's finally coming.
Okay. I hope not. I have one other UW football one. I don't know if you have any other ones. Savelle Smalls wins Pac-12 Defensive Freshman of the Year, an award that only Taylor Rapp has won for the Huskies.
Really? Since they started
awarding it to specifically to defensive players in 2009.
They just haven't played that many freshmen.
They haven't played a fair number.
They haven't played that many good freshmen. I feel like it's a very good shot to win that.
That might not be bold enough. But I wanted to get one correct this year.
Jimmy Lake will win his first Apple Cup as a head coach en route to the Huskies winning the Pac-12 North.
Oh, you love predicting these multiple scenarios. I love it. I do not feel the Huskies are going to win the Pac-12.
Who's the competition right now?
Yes, Oregon will
it's
not be the
same.
It's going
to be a pretty weak Pac-12 North.
We'll see.
You're really counting on Oregon State being good.
Well, maybe Cal will stay ahead alphabetically of the Huskies.
I mean, if Jacob Eason comes back next year, as you just boldly predicted, like the chances that they would go into the year the favorites in the North.
Probably. Should we do the Seahawks now?
I want to do the Seahawks one at the end.
Okay. Well, I only have one other non-Seahawks one, which is not specifically tied to a team. Amazon Web Services will be announced as the sponsor of the new arena at Seattle Center.
Wow. Man, if they do that, there is going to be some protesting.
Named AWS Arena. You'll note that Amazon Web Services CEO Andy Jassy is an investor in the NHL team.
Wow. I don't know if you're aware of what's happening in the world of music and with regards to Amazon Web Services. And response that Amazon Web Services has gotten on the internet.
More to the money that Amazon Web Services brings in that I'm aware of.
I mean, I'm sure that the outrage would not stop them, but there are some hockey fans who'd feel a little bit questionable about it.
Okay.
That's a good bold prediction, though.
Thank you. That was like the first one I wrote down. I'm like, that's a good bold prediction.
Quade Green will enter the ESPN Draft 100 after his performance in an upset of Gonzaga.
Oh, in 20. Okay. Huh. In Spokane next year at the Kennel. All right. I don't think it's going to happen, but okay.
We've got a year. You don't think anybody's going to get in the ESPN Draft 100 until
Carter
it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. Seahawks time? Do you have any other non-Seahawks ones?
Nope.
I'm going the inverse of Mina here. The LA Rams will win the NFC West in 2020, taking advantage of a third-place schedule.
Man, I really considered a Cardinals one.
Oh, that would have been a good one.
A Cardinals bold prediction.
Kyler Murray leads them to the playoffs.
Really? If you had to rank 1 through 4 the NFC West for next year, It's just, it's all a crapshoot.
I mean, the 49ers probably should still be the favorites if they have a massive point differential this year. But.
Okay. I could not rank the NFC West teams next season 1 through 4. I mean, I could do it, but I would not feel confident in those rankings.
Yeah.
Any of the four teams could finish in any place. But the Seattle Seahawks are unable to re-sign Jadeveon Clowney when he has become too expensive on the open market after winning the Super Bowl MVP, stifling Lamar Jackson in the Ravens offense. The Ravens will only keep it close because of an Earl Thomas pick six in the fourth quarter.
You know what? I had thought about when we were talking about Earl Thomas earlier. A good bold prediction would be Earl Thomas picks off Russell Wilson in the Super Bowl, but
if I wasn't going to go that far. Earl Thomas is getting a pick in that game.
I mean, he already did, didn't he?
Marcus Peters did.
Oh, that was Peters. Yeah, that's right.
This is the last sort of tacked on bold prediction because we probably won't know a year from today. But
well, should I do my last one then?
Yeah, do your last one.
I really struggled with the Seahawks. I contemplated saying that they will re-sign Clowney as a bold prediction, but I don't know if that's sufficiently bold. Here's what I ended up going with. Travis Homer will start a game for the Seahawks in 2020.
2020 leading rusher, Travis Homer.
That seems too far. Leading rusher.
Travis Homer has an okay chance of... But Chris Carson probably will be the prohibitive favorite for starting running back next season. Especially with Penny coming off of injuries and everything. But it was like Travis Homer could either be released.
Right.
Or he could be like a competent NFL starting running back by next year. Somewhere, like anywhere in between there.
Yep, all possibilities are in play.
So I had to let my Travis Homer dreams go. But for something about us just loves Travis Homer. He better get a carry this Sunday. My last bold prediction is the 2020 season will be Pete Carroll's last as head coach of the Seattle Seahawks.
I don't know if you understand win forever.
I don't know if you understand that he's going to be like 79 years old.
I do understand that. I don't think it's going to stop him. I don't feel that's an issue at all. Also, I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, there's a photo that comes out of Pete Carroll this offseason where he looks like Kumail Nanjiani. So, you know, again, all things are in play.
Pete Carroll jacked. next year, he would be 69 years old.
Nice.
So almost 70.
I don't believe him. So I'm going to bet against your bold prediction. I mean, obviously, it's easy to bet against all the bold predictions. Yeah, that's why they're bold predictions. But that one in particular, I bet against. We should have done bold predictions for the entire 2020s.
For the decade?
Pete Carroll is still the Seahawks head coach in 2029.
That's yeah, we can come up with some. Do you want to throw these down?
Oh, no.
The Mariners won't make the playoffs in the decade. I think that Jimmy Lake will not be the head coach of the Huskies by 2026.
Because he's gone somewhere else or because he's been fired? Chris Peterson returns to UW as head coach after Jimmy Lake. The Huskies have several new quarterbacks named Jake or Jacob.
All the Jakes.
Do we have any bold predictions for the Pelton cast in the 2020s?
Oh, just all emergency pods.
I would have to say if we're looking back on the 2010s, and definitely the best decade ever for the Pelton cast.
Oh, yeah. Huge decade.
Yeah.
It feels like we've been doing this podcast for more than a decade.
Just like it feels that, like, what did you say earlier that happened in April that felt like it was more
the Russell Wilson extension?
Oh, yeah.
But this was the best decade of the Pelton cast so far, and we look forward to having you join us for the next decade of the Pelton cast.
And boldly predict that the listener... And just the listener will continue to listen in the 2020s.
We can boldly predict more shameful sponsorships, as much spawn con as you can imagine. Pagliacci is the Pelton cast.
They'll get naming rights much like AWS will get to the arena. Yeah. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much for listening this year and as long as you have in the 2010s.